Hello and welcome to the Feeling Good Podcast. I am your host, Fabrice Nye, and joining me here in the Murrieta Studios is Dr. David Burns. Hi, David.
Hi, Fabrice.
Dr. David Burns has been a pioneer in the development of cognitive therapy, and he is the creator of the new team therapy. He is the author of Feeling Good, which has sold over 5 million copies in the United States and has been translated into over 20 languages. He is an emeritus adjunct clinical professor of psychiatry at the Stanford University School of Medicine. And we're having a special podcast today with a distinguished guest host, Lisa Kelly, in Littleton, Colorado. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Fabrice. How are you today?
Good. Lisa is a team therapist. She's also a former journalist. And she and David wrote an article, an interview actually, on a very controversial question: can depression be treated successfully in 2 hours? And so you're going to get a little taste of that article in today's podcast. And Lisa will be the one doing the interview of David this time. So I'm going to step back, and I will also give David a little bit of a chance to introduce Lisa, because he knows her much better than I do. So, David, on to you.
Oh, well, thanks. I might add that we just want to make people aware of this blog that I have published on my website, feelinggood.com. And if you're interested, based on the podcast, you can go and read the entire interview on my website.
Yeah, we will put a link in the show notes.
Oh, great.
So you have access to the entire PDF article.
Yeah, but the way it came about is Lisa has been a very enthusiastic participant in the team certification program, and because of her background in journalism and marketing, has pointed out to me before I did a workshop in Denver on the treatment of trauma that we need to work harder to let people, both the general public as well as therapists, know about some of the new developments in psychotherapy that we're really quite excited about. And so we decided, you know, one approach would be to do an interview and have Lisa ask me some of the questions that an interested therapist or someone struggling with depression or anxiety or someone who's been experienced severe trauma to ask questions so we could highlight some of these new developments. And I'm very thrilled to have the chance to work with Lisa, as well as of course, work with you, Fabrice. And by the way, happy birthday, Fabrice. Today is Fabrice's birthday. So
oh, thank you.
So why don't you give your introductory blurb, Lisa, and see what you'd like to say, and then we can kind of dive in and discuss this thing.
Okay. Thanks, David. And I have to say it's a pleasure working with you, and I couldn't be more pleased with the article, the interview that we worked so hard on. The outcome was really good. So, David, I'm going to jump right in here and start our interview. David, you recently asked this question in a survey on your website. Do you believe that a depressed individual could experience a complete elimination of symptoms in a single 2-hour therapy session? How did people respond?
Okay, well, a lot. We had over 5,000 people have responded to that survey so far, and while some of them thought this might be possible, most did not. And even of those who thought it might be possible for people to experience a complete elimination of symptoms or near complete elimination of symptoms in a single extended therapy session, most kind of dismissed it as thinking that, well, even if you could do that, it wouldn't stick. So I'd say overall people were quite skeptical about this possibility.
Yes, indeed, it does kind of sound far out there, to be frank. What's your opinion? Can depression be treated in a single session?
Well, if someone had made that statement you know, as recently as 10 years ago, I would have written them off as a con artist, and I wouldn't really have wanted to hear what they had to say or read what they had to write, because it would have seemed pretty ridiculous. And I would say, you know, that certainly for all patients that may not be possible, but my own experience in treating some pretty seriously depressed and anxious individuals over the past several years has indicated that it sometimes is possible, and I've been kind of shocked to see that. And while I wouldn't want to hold out the promise that all therapists can do this or can be done in all treatment settings or with all patients, I've seen it happen, you know, over and over again. For example, I should say right off the bat that I'm no longer in clinical practice, but I still treat people in a way in my teaching, in my workshops, and in the training groups I do at Stanford for community therapists. And as a part of the treatment, people often do personal work. Mm-hmm. And in my most recent workshop, which is a trauma workshop, the evening of day one of the workshop, it's a two-day workshop, I ask for a volunteer who's usually a therapist who's experienced pretty severe trauma to do some live work. And I work with the person for about, generally 2 hours in front of the live audience. And I would say I've probably done 35 or 50 or more of these in the last several years. And 90% of the time, by the end of the session, the person has experienced a complete or near-complete elimination of feelings of depression and anxiety and anger and shame and mm-hmm. and hopelessness and that type of thing. And it's very, very exciting to see that at least some of the time this does seem to be possible. Mm-hmm. And I think understanding why it's happening and how it's happening can give us important insights about how psychotherapy works and some tools that could maybe make most therapists much more effective in their clinical work, even if they're not aiming for this single session effect. I think if we can use tools to speed up recovery from depression and anxiety, it would be a tremendous blessing.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, you referred to traumas. What kind of traumas are you speaking of? And you say that in most cases, in these 35 to 50 demonstrations that you've done, you've seen, you know, almost a complete reduction in symptoms, and these are quite dramatic. What kind of symptoms are you referring to?
Well, I think you just asked two questions. One is, what kind of traumas have these people experienced, and what kind of symptoms do they have? Mm-hmm. Both good questions. The traumas have been the entire range from, severe accidents with, physical pain and physical disabilities, rape, horrific medical illnesses, diagnoses of terminal cancer or this type of thing. One was a mother whose daughter had been shot in the face by some boy when she went out to play by boys who were playing with a high-powered pellet rifle, and this woman had experienced 10 years of guilt and shame and struggling with her daughter through multiple surgeries and treatments. Just a war. I had a veteran with sometimes it's childhood traumas, war traumas, horrific childhood sexual abuse. Sometimes there are individuals who have had repeated traumas, throughout their entire lives. And the symptoms that they experience include, moderate to extreme depression. They generally have severe or extreme anxiety and sometimes panic. They have feelings of inferiority, worthlessness, defectiveness, Often they feel ashamed because they're blaming themselves for the trauma or for not measuring up to this or that expectation. Often they feel alone, lonely, rejected, unwanted. Often they feel humiliated, sometimes embarrassed to be disclosing these things in front of a live audience. There's often feelings of hopelessness or discouragement, frustration, and almost always, you know, anger, resentment, sometimes even, feelings of rage.
How tragic and heartbreaking. My heart goes out to all of them. And David, you're claiming that these symptoms improve significantly in just one session?
Well, that's been my experience. Again, I don't want to hold out, false promises or come across as a con artist or being insensitive, because these problems are very severe and the pain and suffering is very real. But one of the components of team therapy is the T of team, stands for testing. And as you know, Lisa, we measure the severity of the patient's symptoms. How are you feeling right now at the beginning and end of every single therapy session? And so we can see exactly how the patients are feeling, how severe the symptoms are just before the session begins. And then after the session is over, I have the patient or the client, the colleague, whatever word you want to use, repeat the testing. So I can, and again, the tests are asking, how depressed do you feel at this moment? How angry do you feel at this moment? How anxious do you feel at this moment? So you can see exactly how effective you've been or not been in every single therapy session. It's kind of like having an emotional X-ray machine available for the first time, so therapists can see clearly when they're being effective and when they're not being effective. Mm-hmm. The patients also rate the therapist on scales that are very sensitive, that measure how empathic and caring the therapist was, as well as how helpful the therapist was. And what I've been seeing what I've been working with folks is very severe or extreme mood levels at the start of the session. A lot of depression, a lot of anxiety, a lot of anger, and when I begin to talk with the patient, empathize at the start, there's generally a lot of tears and sobbing and a lot of grief and shame is expressed. And then at the end of the session, when we've kind of worked these things through, we see those assessment scales, the scores go down to zero or very, very near zero, and often the person is laughing and joyous and really jubilant. It's almost better than recovery. The person really gets into a kind of enlightened and joyous state. And it's great to see that. And when I started out my practice and for many years, I didn't have tools powerful enough to make this happen. I've always had, since I went into clinical practice and started working with cognitive therapy, lots of tools. And I always had many patients who responded rapidly, but not anywhere to the degree that we're seeing it now when I've been using the new team CBT methods. But again, I don't want to, push this too hard. It's difficult to learn these tools. And in, private practice and clinical practice situation out in the trenches, therapists are going to have a lot of very challenging, difficult patients who won't be able to respond this rapidly. But again, I think that we're looking at what looks like, to me, like very significant advances in psychotherapy.
Oh, that sounds so encouraging, especially for these poor people who are suffering so immensely. David, could you give me an example of the kinds of changes you've seen? Maybe, a case example, someone who's come to your workshops and that you've seen improve so dramatically over the 2 hours that you spend?
Well, there have been a lot of them. In the article, I describe a patient who's who's disguised her identity, but I call her Christine as a Asian American woman who's a clinical social worker. But in one of the workshops recently here in California, she volunteered and described, you know, decades of rape and marital violence and just a horrific situation that went on. And although at the time of the workshop she had finally gotten divorced and safely separated from her husband, she was still carrying around enormous feelings of depression, anxiety, and anger, and she had a lot of very negative thoughts that were triggering these feelings that she told us about at the beginning of the workshop. Kind of let me page down here a little bit, and I can say some of what she was thinking and telling herself from a cognitive therapy perspective. Here we go. This is what we're looking for. Our thoughts create our moods. This idea goes back to the time of Epictetus, nearly 2,000 years ago, and even all the way back to the Buddha, 2,500 years ago, that our thoughts create our feelings. And so even when you've had something horrific happen to you, the feelings that you have will be created by the way you think about it. And and Christine was telling her things like, you know, I'm not safe, I can't trust men, you know, I should have stopped the abuse, I victimized myself, I must be defective, I was cowardly, things like that, I lived a lie and I shouldn't have. And then those were a lot of her self-critical thoughts. And then she was also had thoughts that the therapist in the audience who were watching the live demonstration would judge her and be critical of her and think that she should have left her husband long before she did. And she also was convinced that they would be thinking, how could she be a good therapist and help others when she can't even help herself? And maybe people listening to the podcast right now have had thoughts like this, not identical to Christine's, because the circumstances of our lives are all different. But it's very sad that when somebody hurts us, takes advantage of us, and whether you're a child or an adult, there's a tendency to turn against yourself and to blame yourself and to think you must be bad or defective or this wouldn't be happening to you, and these thoughts can create just tremendous pain and suffering.
Boy, she was really beating on herself, and then imagining that other people were being just as harsh and criticizing her. She just really must have been so traumatized, even after the initial trauma.
Lisa, do you ever do that to yourself?
Yeah, I'm afraid I do.
I'm just trying to bring you out of the interview and into the current moment here a little bit, Lisa.
I have to admit, I've been through trauma myself, and as a result of working and training in Team CBT, I've had to, you know, identify these thoughts that were haranguing me and work through them on the daily mood log. I hope this doesn't come off as a sales job, but I would have to say Team CBT changed my life, and currently I don't have any depression or anxiety.
Yeah, oh, that's great to hear. I wasn't pushing for so much of a testimonial there, but my point was really that most of us get kicked in the stomach by life. Mm-hmm. And the pain can be just unbearable, and to have tools to bring hope and to bring joy and tools that have some power, so you just don't have to go to the therapist endlessly. And I know when I was a psychiatric resident, I was just trained to say, you know, tell me more, I wasn't allowed to kind of do anything to try to help the patient. And it's great to have powerful tools now. But one of the innovations has been learning how to bring the patient's resistance to change to conscious awareness before you try to use any of these tools, and then to melt away that resistance so that the patient is working with the therapist as a team. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, sometimes real magic can occur. We've got all of these new tools in therapy, and there's new schools of therapy emerging all the time. You've got cognitive behavior therapy, CBT, and then dialectical behavior therapy, DBT, and then you've got EMDR and ACT, and on and on and on, with hundreds of schools of therapy, and they're emerging, you know, almost on a weekly basis, you know, mindfulness-based CBT, and everyone is thinking they've got the answer. But when you look at the outcome studies for all these different forms of psychotherapy for depression, they all seem to come out about the same, and about the same as antidepressant medications, and that's barely better than placebo. Mm. And it's, you know, maybe 50% of patients can be treated in most of these outcome studies in a, you know, reasonably short period of therapy. But from my point of view, that's not very good. And I have always wondered about, well, how about the 50% of patients who don't recover quickly? Or even after months and months of therapy and after many, many antidepressant drugs, why are they stuck, and could we find some tools to help them get unstuck? And that's really kind of what Team CBT has been all about, is to understand at a deeper and more practical level why people get stuck in depression or anxiety or troubled relationships or habits and addictions, and then how we can help overcome the resistance to change quite quickly. And Fabrice, you can be jumping in here too, you know.
Well, I was looking at the, a little bit farther down into the article, and one thing that has always really felt very important in the Team CBT approach is how you can melt resistance, because before I knew the model, I constantly hurt myself with the resistance I was encountering with my clients, and of course my reaction was to just push harder.
Well, yeah.
Well, don't you understand this is going to help you?
Yes, I'm so happy to hear you saying this, Fabrice, because I made that same mistake for years myself, thinking I only needed enough techniques.
Exactly. It's all about the techniques. But it's not. It's about understanding that there are reasons for our clients to not change, and many reasons. But until those reasons are addressed, there's no moving forward.
Yeah.
And I really encourage people to go and see the full article, because you go into great details about what that means.
Yeah, absolutely. I love what you're saying. You just put it in an elegant nutshell there.
Well, I have to jump in here, guys. You know, I'm confused. Why would anyone who's suffering and who comes to therapy and pays good money and takes the time to show up, why would anybody resist change? Why would they get into a power struggle with a therapist who's trying so hard to help them and to eliminate that suffering? I just don't get that.
Yeah. For decades, I would say, therapists have thought about resistance as something negative about the patient, almost like a character flaw, or that the patient is kind of whiny and wants to feel sorry for themselves, or they're afraid to change, or they're trying to get sympathy, or the negativity is a part of their identity, so they're afraid to lose their identity. And the problem with those ways of looking at resistance is that they're kind of patronizing and they're put downs, as if the resistance is some flaw that the patient has. Mm-hmm. And what we have discovered, the good news, is a radically different way of looking at resistance, as revealing something beautiful and awesome about the patient, and that there's very real benefits to the patient, and feeling anxious or angry or depressed. And so the new role of the therapist becomes, rather than trying to help the patient change, try to help the patient understand the reasons that he or she might be reluctant to change, and also to become proud of those reasons and to become proud of the resistance, and then to wonder with the patient, well, maybe change isn't such a good idea, and for the therapist to become the voice of the patient's resistance in a respectful and kindly way. And I'll just give you one brief example of how we do this to get the full picture. I think people would have to go to the website and read the article. But one thing is that after I had empathized with Christine, and that took about 30 minutes, and a lot of tears came out, and at one point she became so terrified she said she wanted to just run off of the stage. She was feeling so ashamed and embarrassed and anxious, but she stuck it out. And then at a certain point I said, you know, how am I doing in terms of empathy? And, you know, do you feel I've understood you and accepted you? Do you feel safe? And she said she did, and she gave me an A or an A-plus on empathy. And you've got to get to that before you can do anything else. And then I asked her, you know, If something really tremendous happened here tonight, and kind of like a miracle, and you went out of the session saying, boy, that was the greatest 2 hours of my life, what miracle would you ask for? I can't guarantee that I could provide that miracle, but I'd want to know what you'd hope for. And she said if she could finally, after, you know, more than 40 years of you know, failed treatment to overcome her severe depression and anxiety and anger, she said, if I could get over those feelings and if it would disappear and I could leave with a feeling of joy and self-esteem and to celebrate life, that would be the miracle. And then I said, well, suppose there's a magic button here, and if you press this magic button, Christine, you'll instantly feel euphoric and all the negative thoughts and feelings would disappear. With no effort, would you press the button? And like practically every patient, she said, yeah, well, of course I'd press the button. And then I said, well, I'm not sure that's such a good idea. I do have powerful tools, and I suspect it might be possible and probably will be possible for us to cause dramatic reductions in all of these symptoms, but I don't know if we'd want to do that. Why don't we make a list together of all the positive things about you that these feelings reveal, as well as some of the benefits? What are some good things about these negative thoughts and feelings? And like, you know, 99% of patients, she was dumbfounded and said, I can't think of anything. And that shows how our culture views depression and anxiety. You know, the American Psychiatric Association calls these, you know, mental disorders. Like, you're depressed, you're anxious, so you have an anxiety disorder or a mood disorder, as if it's some defect caused by a chemical imbalance in the brain or some such thing. And we're coming in from a different angle. And just to give you a simple example, I said, Christine, let's start with something simple here. Like your anxiety, you're 100% anxious. You're as panicky and frightened and anxious as a human being can be. It can't get more severe than what you're experiencing right now. And if you press that magic button, your anxiety will instantly disappear. Can you think of some reasons why you might not want that to happen? And let me ask the podcast listeners right now, can you think of some reasons why Christine might not want her anxiety to disappear?
Yeah, pause the podcast right now and think about this for a moment.
Good idea.
We won't pause, but...
Okay, we'll keep
people
going.
People can pause at home. Yeah,
yeah, right. So can you think of some reasons, Fabrice? I know we haven't discussed it. This is a kind of a no-brainer, an obvious one.
Well, one thing that comes to mind for me is that... after all, you know, if I were Christine, after all the terrible things that happened to me, how could I even think about being happy. I'm not supposed to be happy.
Well, that's a good one for the depression. Yeah, that shows the good thing about the depression. Like it's appropriate to feel sad and depressed when you've had 40 years of suffering, and it also reveals your passion for life. But going back to the anxiety, you know, she's anxious and she's telling herself, "I'm not safe. I can't trust men." Can you, Lisa, think of some advantages for her in being anxious? What are some benefits to her? Why would it be incredibly important for the anxiety not to disappear?
Well, you know, the purpose of anxiety historically has been to protect us. And so the anxiety might serve to keep her safe.
Absolutely. And she mentioned that she had recently met a fellow and some flirtations had occurred, and she was interested in him, and since he was interested in her. And if the anxiety disappears, well, then she lets her guard down and she might be taken advantage of again, get in another abusive relationship. So the anxiety is really kind of a form of self-love, you might say, and it's a very positive thing that she wouldn't want to disappear. Now, Fabrice has let me know we got to wind this down so we don't get too long. So to make a long story short, we did this, which is called positive reframing, with all of her negative feelings, her self-criticism, show her high standards. Her high standards have made her incredibly productive. She's accomplished a lot. Her anger, too, is absolutely justified. People can be cruel and horrible, and it's absolutely right to feel anger over what's happened to her and so forth. And so together we came up with a list of, I think, 18 positive, beautiful qualities about her that were embedded in her negative thoughts and feelings. And at that point, she suddenly no longer has to feel ashamed of these feelings. She can be proud of them and understand that they served a very positive function. And then the goal of the therapy becomes not to make them disappear entirely, but just to reduce them to some reasonable lower level. And she was fine with that. And at that point, her mood had already changed dramatically. And then I came in with some cognitive therapy techniques. That's the last part of the team model. It's testing, empathy, agenda setting, and methods. And I used identified the distortions, examined the evidence, the paradoxical double standard technique, the externalization of voices, and the experimental technique, and she just hit the ball out of the park. I mean, it was remarkably, all this push and pull that you see in therapy just didn't happen. She'd had a loving, powerful voice inside of her the whole time. She herself is a very fine and compassionate and effective therapist, and it was just allowing her, giving herself permission to bring that healing to herself. And by the end of the session, her feelings had gone down pretty much to zero. Or very, you know, the depression went to zero, the anger went, you know, from 100 to zero. And the anxiety went from 100% just down to 10% because she wanted to hang on to a little anxiety, and that was it. And she was in a state of jubilation. And then I recently did a little 6-month follow-up on her, sent her an email. She's still high and happy and joyous, and she says when the negative thoughts try to come back, she's like a laser beam, and she just crushes them. And she's just still, her scores are still, you know, as fantastic as they were at the end of that session. So to bring the podcast to a close, I would say that we have some very new and different strategies, ways of working with people who are hurting, and that these strategies may have the power to speed up therapy, maybe not as dramatically as what I'm seeing in workshops, but to speed therapy up significantly. And we're planning an outcome study. One of my former students and now a dear colleague at Stanford, Kim Bullock, and another former student who set up the Feeling Good Institute, Moore Katz, we're now developing a protocol to test the new team CBT in a real-world setting to see what the effectiveness is. And we have to hold back on getting too excited until we see what that outcome study shows. But personally, I'm feeling really grateful to have had so many colleagues to help develop these new techniques, not only the two of you, but Jill Levitt and Helen Yenny Compsian and Daniel Levy and many fantastic colleagues who I teach with in the free training groups we have every year, every week at Stanford for community therapists who want to learn more about these approaches. And if there are therapists listening who want to learn more about these approaches, there are also week online training groups. If you go to the website of the www.feelinggoodinstitute.com, there's abundant resources there for ongoing training, and then also on my own website, feelinggood.com.
And of course, keep listening to this podcast, because we'll be doling out a lot of very useful information.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, teaching all about the team therapy through this podcast.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I almost forgot.
Well, I want to thank you both, Fabrice and David, for asking me to, or inviting me to participate today. Working with you has been the highlight of my career. And personally and professionally, I can't imagine any other way I could have grown to this point. And I just want to thank you again.
Oh, you're very welcome. And I feel the same way. I've been able to teach a lot of people through the program at Stanford and through my workshops, but it's been probably more helpful to me than any of my students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's for sure.
There's one thing that I wanted to add to this, and I just want to check this with you, David, is one thing that I noticed that the experiences that you're talking about seem to have happened in a lot of cases when you were giving workshops or intensives, right?
Absolutely, or at Stanford or on the Sunday hikes.
So one thing that I've learned in doing research is that when we select participants for studies, we sometimes want to not have a selection bias. And I know that the people who come to your trainings tend to be people who have it together enough to have a therapy practice,
right,
to have successfully completed a graduate degree, and are motivated enough to come up in front of a room full of 200 people and talk with the eminent Dr. Burns.
Right.
So there's already like a priming happening there.
Yes, that's right. And that's why this might not generalize in the same way to a clinical practice situation. People have to be pretty motivated to get up in front of an audience and share their most intimate details and be really hungry for change. That, of course, would also underscore the importance of motivation in treatment. I've always done live demonstrations and workshops from time to time, even going back to the early 1980s. And in the past, I also saw rapid recoveries, but not at nearly the rate I'm seeing them now. So there does seem to be something changed. One other last point we want to make is that after that initial recovery, people are going to have tendencies to relapse. No one's allowed to be happy all the time. So you've got to do good relapse prevention training as well. And I have a second, briefer article that I'm editing now that I'll put on the website soon about relapse prevention training and how to do it.
All right. Well, that was a great podcast from my point of view, because I got to be an audience, really. and I hope that you get a lot of downloads of this article, because I think that of all the things you've written, it really goes into very understandable depth about how resistance works and how to melt it. So thank you so much, Lisa, for being our guest interviewer today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And you, David, for your relentless giving of your wisdom and knowledge.
Yeah, thanks very much. Hope everyone has a great day. And this is holiday season. Of course, when they hear it, holiday season will be over. But,
We'll try to publish this one a little bit sooner so that it doesn't have to wait too long. All right. Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This has been another episode of the Feeling Good Podcast. For more information, visit Dr. Burns' website at feelinggood.com, where you will find the show notes for this podcast under the blog page, and where you can leave your comments and questions. The website has an abundance of resources for therapists as well as non-therapists, including books, workshops, a list of online training groups around the world, and much more. Theme music is Gypsy Jazz in Paris, 1935, composed and performed by Brett Van Donzel. I am your host, Fabrice Nye, and I invite you to join us next time for another episode of the Feeling Good Podcast.